Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to learn how resveratrol, that's what you get when you eat grapes, can help correct hormone imbalance in women with PCOS. By the way, PCOS is polycystic ovary syndrome. University of California, published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. That and a lot more on how we can live a longer and healthier life. Then, probably another 30 minutes, we devoted to a brand new, in-depth, investigative reporting piece. Richard Gale, myself, are challenging Wikipedia. We're challenging those individuals who believe that only they are correct when it comes to what we should be doing for our health. Our article is entitled Modern Skepticism, the Rise of Scientific Wahhabism. And Wahhabism is the most radical form of Islam practiced by Saudi Arabia and some of the other places in the Middle East and around the world. So this is a thinking person's discussion. This is a deeper discussion. And I know that there are people in the audience who appreciate deeper, more scholarly, and thoughtful discussions on issues. And that's because right now there is an effort by Facebook, Google, and other accounts, major internet accounts, to scrub, eliminate, and completely black out anything involving complementary medicine. For example, if you Google alternative cancer treatments, you're not going to be given alternative cancer treatments. You'll be given an orthodox protocol. You'll be taken to an orthodox page. But if you go to Wikipedia, anything on alternative cancer will be told it's unscientific and fraudulent. The people advocating it are frauds, and it's not true. So we've been doing 55 articles up to today. Today is number 56. It's a longer piece, but we decided to do something different, as you'll see when we share this with you today. But we always begin with the latest in health and healing, and don't forget to write down these numbers. The numbers are to listen to the program in the archives at your leisure, anytime, 24/7, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. To listen live, Monday to Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, Tuesday 7 to 8 at night, write this number down, please, 774-337-6068, 774-337-6068. And that way, when for whatever reason you can't hear us on your local station, you'll always be able to hear us on PRN. Now, let's go to the subject of resveratrol. Now, a lot of people only heard about resveratrol when they were told that drinking red wine provided it to them, and they are correct. However, please keep it in perspective. Red wine is consumed all over the Mediterranean. It is low alcohol content. Frequently it is made in people's own homes from their own vineyards. I went into a man's house who was a neighbor of my friend who had a house in France, and he had 12,000 bottles that he had made, and he shared it with his friends and family. He just allowed it to ferment naturally. And depending upon the grapes he was growing and how long they had been in their casks, and the wines tasted different. But this is like you and I having a glass of tea or apple juice. Now, that is healthy. unless they use sulfates, which is bad for your lungs, and it's a toxicant. It's a carcinogen also. That's why if you're going to buy organic wine, sulfate-free. But there's about 5 to 7 milligrams in an average glass of wine of resveratrol. But if you eat the grapes, you get more. And by the way, they eat a lot of grapes in the Mediterranean area. In fact, it's very common to finish a meal, especially in Italy, where you'll have fruit as your dessert. And they understand that having fruit actually aids in digestion of a meal. And they're actually correct about that. And many of the fruits they eat will be fermenting in the body and creating prebiotics. Grapes are one of them. That's why grapes are one of nature's most perfect foods. I try to have several hundred milligrams of resveratrol every day, including eating grapes wherever possible, or taking a grape concentrate powder. But if you want the largest amount of resveratrol, have some Concord grape juice, or simply take a tablet of resveratrol, or any combination. But what it will do is this. It is the compound in grapes, and it can help address a hormone imbalance in women with polycystic ovary syndrome, which, by the way, is a leading cause of infertility in women. How bad is it? I decided to look up the science on this. There are about 5 to 6 million women currently in the United States who have polycystic ovary syndrome. That's according to the Hormone Health Network. It's one of the most common endocrine conditions in women of childbearing age. And women who have this condition produce slightly higher amounts of testosterone and other androgen hormones than average. And although these reproductive hormones are typically associated with men, women also have small amounts, just like men have small amounts of estrogen. And the elevated levels in women with the condition can contribute to irregular and absent menstrual cycles and infertility and weight gain and acne and excess hair on the face and the body. And women who have this condition also face a higher risk of developing other health problems like diabetes. So resveratrol is one of a group of plant compounds, and they're called polyphenols, P-O-L-Y, polyphenols. P-H-E-N-O-L-S. In addition to red wine and grapes, you can find it in nuts. Yeah, walnuts and almonds. And it's strongly anti-inflammatory. So if you have arthritis, if you have heart disease, cancer, definitely consider using this. And by the way, this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial conducted at Poznan University of Medical Sciences in Poznan, Poland. And the women received either the placebo or resveratrol every day for 3 months, and then blood was drawn at the beginning and end of the study to determine levels of testosterone and other androgen hormones. And the women also underwent an oral glucose tolerance test at the start and conclusion. And the conclusion was that testosterone fell by 23% among women who received the resveratrol, and that's a good thing. So, just something extra, a piece of the puzzle of health that we can use. From the University of British Columbia comes a study published in the American Academy of Neurology's journal, and it says that exercise can benefit elderly people with memory and thinking problems. According to their study, exercise is important the older you get in life. It can absolutely positively improve your memory and thinking problems. And yet when I was growing up, and I'm sure many of the people listening, the older you were, the less you were supposed to do things like exercise. You were to take it easy. Well, we were giving just the wrong advice. In fact, when we looked in the cultures in the United States, those people living in suburban and urban areas, especially those who had worked in offices, were sitting a lot, They died much sooner. They had more osteoporosis, more heart disease. People living in the country who didn't really retire. No one ever retires when you live in the country. There's just too many chores. And you keep yourself busy. And people living in other countries that didn't retire. You go to Italy and you go in the mountain areas. It's beautiful in the mountain areas around the Italian Alps. You see people getting up early and doing chores all day long. They're physically active. That keeps them healthier longer. But now science is showing that you want to improve vascular cognitive condition and you want to improve memory. You want to lessen the likelihood of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Exercise. I think you should exercise. For every 10 years, every decade, after the age of 50, you should increase your exercise by about 15 minutes a day. And that way, the older you get, the more exercise you do. I work with a lot of senior citizens, and it works. In fact, right now, this is halfway through the anti-aging clinical study, and the results we're getting are nothing less than phenomenal. People have lost weight. One woman lost 21 pounds as of today. Right now, as I'm speaking, we have a film crew in the gym taking people through their, every 2 weeks we do a measurement of all their body work, how many push-ups and sit-ups, how fast they do it, how many they do it, how much weight they can lift. And we're seeing as much as a 400% increase in their endurance and strength and stamina and their flexibility and range of motion. So it's very exciting. And some of these people are 95 years of age. In fact, the woman who's 95 who couldn't walk 10 feet just this morning walked 4 miles. 4 miles at 95. And didn't do it slowly. So this is not the objective blood checks that we're going to also see. And when those are done, I'll publish the results so you can see them for yourself. And then hopefully we can spread this information and everybody can start to improve their health. In any case, the older you get, the more important exercise becomes, the more important learning new languages become, the more important doing something creative like art, music, language, all that becomes more important the older you get. From the University of Zurich, this is a different type of study, but it found that overcoming egocentricity increases self-control. What do I mean? Well, according to their study, it was a good study. If you ask yourself, for example, should I buy a new car now? Or maybe save the money for retirement or for a rainy day. Now, such situations require self-control in order to resist the immediate tempting offer for the sake of more important outcomes in the future. It's widely accepted that self-control is regulated by mechanisms in the brain area called the prefrontal cortex, with the ability to keep oneself at bay when tempted by immediately appealing offers. In fact, just this morning in the kitchen, we have two master chefs that were flown in so that every meal is a gourmet, vegan, just beautiful presentation, the plating. And we take an hour to eat. We eat in silence so that we can focus all of our energy upon the food and the mindfulness of that moment to be relaxed, to maximize beneficial digestion. And one of the chefs said, you want to try this dessert? And I said, I'm sorry, I don't eat dessert, but I'll do this. You know, I'll be happy to take a piece of this dessert and just to taste it. And I did. It was very good. And just using natural fruits, you bring out the natural sweetness. You don't have to use any sugars. And then I spit it out. And I said, I haven't had dessert in 40 years. And is that discipline? Well, gee whiz, the chef said. I'm not sure I could, you know, be that disciplined. I said, sure you can. You're very disciplined upon what you feel is important. Well, I still am living with that discipline my parents taught me, who lived through the Great Depression and many privations, that if I can't afford it, don't buy it. And so I've gone without on many occasions in my life. And I was talking with a group, mainly, let's say, people, today's the last day for the health support group, the retreaters. And by the way, just as an aside so I don't forget, we've had sitting in our office hundreds upon hundreds of premiums that people pay BAI for, that we paid for, and they're not picking it up. So I no longer trust communicating with people who don't care. So if Mitchell Cohen happens to be a listener, Jane Dingman, or some of the others, or Alex Steinberg, or Steve Brown, please arrange to come down to the office, pick up all the premiums, a car can do it, and take them over and mail them out. The people need their premiums. They deserve their premiums. And no one is making any return calls. I'm so disappointed in how they've neglected once again, in a never-ending cycle, doing what is the right thing. So if we have any volunteers who can pick up the premiums and get them out to the people, let's do it. All right? And you can call Sharon at 646-926-5437. 646-926-5437. And she handles all of this. And I don't want to keep hearing that, Gary, we've got, you know, over 1,000 premiums sitting here, and people deserve them. Anyhow, it's just a side thought. But in any case, it comes back to, what are you able to say no to? Even though you want something, but you realize, should I save that money? Should I bypass this opportunity? Should I reevaluate what I already have? Let's close. Last night I did a lecture. My voice is a little strained because I did 8 hours of lectures yesterday because we have a film crew here, so I just wanted to film them. By the way, these are not lectures for the group who are here. They were all invited and they stayed in on them. These are a whole new set of lectures I'm doing to make my self-empowerment series I've been doing for decades, like Overcoming the Dark Side and Anger, Taming the Beast Within, and Letting Go of Fear. Anyhow, I now have 23 new lectures that I've done and filmed, and now we go through the process of filming some of the brightest minds we can find in the world and putting their opinions in there and adding music and B-roll, and then in the near future, probably in the next 3 to 4 months, you'll be able to see these. In any case, we all have that moment where we'd like something and our impulse is, I want it, I'm going to buy it. But we should then restrain ourselves, go to neutral, and simply ask a simple question. Do I really need this? Can I do without it? And what will that mean if I do without it? I'll have some extra income I can then apply towards other things I actually need. And this is especially important message for the millennials. You are the most in debt generation in American history. You're the most educated. You've been exposed to the most information of any group in American history. Yet there seems to be a cognitive disconnect. Now, all next week, every day next week, I'm going to be doing a program on debt. How we get into debt, but more importantly, how we get out of it. So we can stop breaking these cycles. I'll just give you one example. Every single college and university in the United States, on their first day in class, they'll see table after table after table set up, and there are the banks and financial companies wanting to write you up right there and give you a credit card with $1,000 credit line, or a payday loan, or an installment loan. And people are tempted to do this. And many times, students will get as many as they can. After all, it doesn't cost anything to get a credit card initially. And now you're thinking, hey, I just got 20 credit cards, so I've got $20,000 worth of money that I can spend if I need to on things. And then people forget how important it is to be very frugal, because so many people are not. So many people have parents that can pay for everything for them. Either the working class, who are at the higher end, or the rich. But the average person doesn't take much going in, maybe $500 to $1,000 they got in the bank, if that. So they use those credit cards, and then suddenly they don't read the fine print of the interest. If you don't make a full payment, it goes way up. If you don't miss a payment, it really goes up. And then one day, they're saddled with debt, and they become a part of debt peonage. All next week, adults, seniors, teenagers, millennials, governments, corporations, everything about debt. A real eye-opener. But in any case, it gets back to the idea, save your money for when you need it, because you never know when you're going to need it. That's the takeaway message. And this, you know, this is a study that showed that when you have money, or you think you can buy whatever you want, pay later, that's a part of what they're calling ego-centric behavior, thinking about yourself and your need rather than what you really should have. And that requires self-control. That's the takeaway message, but it's a good message, and we have to remind ourselves of it. Two more quick things from the Chinese Academy of Sciences. They found that mulberries, mul, M-U-L, berry, B-E-R-R-Y, mulberry extract activates brown fat, and that helps you burn fat in the body more efficiently and lose weight. That's that adipose tissue. So that's good news. And by the way, mulberries are rich in rutin, R-U-T-I-N, and that is one of the family of flavonoids that are so beneficial for our metabolism. It's good for diabetics. It's good for maintaining a healthy heart and a strong immune system. Something good, and this was published in the FASEB journal, scientific journal. And we found some additional benefits for the omega-3 fatty acids. It can help clear metabolites from your brain. And this was published by the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology and published in their journal. So when I say FASEB, that stands for Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology, very respected. So they're finding that the function of the what is called glymphatic system, which facilitates the clearance of waste from your brain, like a sweeping out the brain of all of its unnecessary and toxic debris. And this promotes the clearance of these metabolites, including the amyloid B peptides. That's a big culprit with Alzheimer's disease. So if you want to have cleaner brains, less Alzheimer's potential, take your omega-3 fatty acids every day. It's very important. And one last thing from Loyola University Health Systems. High blood pressure can impair cognitive function and pose a risk for Alzheimer's. What do I mean? This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Hypertension. It means that when you have high blood pressure and you're, let's say, 35 to 50, that can lead to impaired cognitive function and put you at a really high risk for Alzheimer's. So make sure that you're controlling your blood pressure, garlic, onions, low-salt diet, de-stress with yoga, meditation, journaling, music, and you're not as susceptible to Alzheimer's. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We're 25 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, a special, in-depth, original investigative report on Wikipedia's skeptics. They believe they're the final arbiters of everything on alternative health. We believe they should be challenged, and we're here to offer that challenge. Please stay with us. This is a special report entitled Modern Skepticism, The Rise of Scientific Wahhabism. The history of scientific and medical research is pervaded with examples of denigration and suppression by a dominant scientific elite. In the absence of dissent, innovation and vision that promises progress and reform, a population succumbs to conformity and eventually stagnation. We only need look at Iran under the control of the Ayatollahs, the fundamentalist Taliban in Afghanistan, the Wahhabi zealots in Saudi Arabia, to get a snapshot of a repressive and ill culture that emerges when dissent is outlawed and persecuted. Science, after contorts into a secular religion unto itself, can likewise become totalitarian. Scientists are not less immune to bias, prejudice, and fanaticism than the most staunch religious extremists and zealots. It is not time to make a concerted effort to expose the movement of modern skepticism in its true colors. Or is it? Yes, it is. It's long overdue. So we are speaking on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of clinicians, outstanding men and women of science and healing, like Rupert Sheldrake in Great Britain, Deepak Chopra in the United States. These individuals have been denigrated, their voices stilled. Why? Because they do not subscribe to skepticism, and skepticism has attacked them. So not unlike religious militants who breathe fear and paranoia, and they do, contemporary skepticism likewise is becoming less tolerant of scientific research and non-conventional medical practices outside of its doctrinal domain. As the movement becomes more empowered, bolder, and more popular, it is succeeding in its infiltration of our university campuses to convert young adults and draw them into the madrasas of their journals and skeptic conferences, where they are indoctrinated in a remarkably reductionist and bland philosophy of human existence. On the medical front, skeptical Wahhabism finds its most regressive and hysterical voice in a faction known as science-based medicine. The Society for Science-Based Medicine, founded by Yale neuroscientist and prominent skeptic Stephen Novella, was launched to advocate for reductionist scientific rationality, founded upon skepticism's principles and strategies. In 2009, the Society launched its Institute for Science and Medicine, a nonprofit organization with a mission to influence public health policies and establish standards based upon its medical determinism at the exclusion and complete repulsion of other medical options that the Institute criticizes. High on both the Society's priority list is the condemnation of virtually all complementary and alternative medicine, which includes accusing naturopathy, homeopathy, massage, chiropractic medicine, nutritional therapy and supplements, and all faith-based and mind-body healing modalities as pseudoscience and quackery. Practitioners of these non-drug-based natural therapies are also categorically labeled as irrational, charlatans, frauds, conspiracy theorists, and quacks. The followers of science-based medicine within the skeptic network operate in their delusional belief and their absolute authority, hyper-diligence, and ultra-orthodoxy. Medical research favoring conventional medicine is more often than not framed as unwavering facts, irrefutable truths, unassailable. Well, that leaves absolutely no room for open and honest discussion and debate from dissenting points of view that are in or outside of that paradigm. Science-based medicine may be understood as a recent splinter faction, a breakaway group from evidence-based medicine that has aligned itself with radical skepticism. Evidence-based medicine is often recognized as one of the great advances in modern medicine to emerge during the 20th century. Although science-based medicine endorses evidence-based medicine's premises and principles, it also considers it as incomplete. In an article entitled Hard Science in Medical Schools, Skeptic, David Gorski writes, quote, evidence-based medicine, although a step forward over prior dogma-based medical models, ultimately falls short of making medicine as effective as it can. As currently practiced, evidence-based medicine appears to worship clinical trial evidence above all else, nearly completely ignores basic science consideration, relegating them to the lowest form of evidence, lower than even small case series. This blind spot has directly contributed to the infiltration of quackery into academic medicine and so-called evidence-based medicine, end quote. Consequently, science-based medicine hails itself as the future paradigm for evaluating medical science and recommending best practices and treatments. Yet, its failure lies in contributing absolutely, positively, no original research practice of medicine. Rather, science-based medicine is a repository of sarcasm, mean-spiritedness, egomania, and criticism, all harbingers of a medical inquisition in its witch hunt to defame all complementary and alternative practitioners and their therapies. In recent years, the American Medical Students Association has sponsored an Integrative Medicine Day. Novell and Gorski and other skeptics have damned this effort as, quote, quackademic medicine, end quote, and have published articles excoriating the study of natural health treatments as a threat to science. Writing for the New York Times, complementary alternative medicine science journalist David Breedman called the medical skeptics, quote, prickly anti-alternative medicine warriors, end quote. But skeptics have a long way to go to establish science-based medicine as, quote, new and improved medical paradigm. The tides are turning in the opposite direction. In 2011, U.S. News & World Report reported that 40% of American adults swore by some form of alternative and natural non-drug-based medicine, and 46 medical schools had complementary and alternative medical departments. Novella, one of the skeptics, was characteristically swift to denounce the report with his accusatory customary nonsense. 4 years later, the Association of American Medical Colleges reported that 126 of 132 medical schools across the nation offered required courses in alternative medicine. That same year, a survey analysis published by the Journal of Advanced Medical Education Practice among the 127 different complementary and alternative courses listings gathered in the study, the most frequent were traditional natural medicine, acupuncture, spirituality, and herbology. 25% of courses were associated with personal growth and self-care practice alongside complementary alternative and conventional medical protocols. In the largest national survey of its kind, researchers from UCLA and the University of California, San Diego measured medical students' attitudes and beliefs about complementary and alternative medicine. The survey found that 84% of medical students believed that conventional medicine could benefit from natural, integrative, and complementary beliefs and ideas and treatment modalities. 77% felt conventional physicians who learned other complementary medical disciplines would benefit their patients. Novell and Gorski's science-based medicine blog literally functions as a clearinghouse for other skeptics to source opinionated and highly prejudiced and biased essays to criticize and debunk complementary and alternative therapies. Even a brief visit to the science-based medicine blog will reveal that approximately 90% of its content is vicious, and scientifically shoddy in the attacks against non-conventional medicine, often accompanied by long-winded rants against those who these natural therapies they feel threatened by. The site largely serves skeptics on the internet and Wikipedia to fuel them with ammunition in their anti-complementary medicine campaigns, which frequently end up on Wikipedia as the final word, the ultimate arbiter of truth in healing. But it's not. A major criticism regarding many of Wikipedia's health pages has been the predominance of amateur editors with no background, no expertise in the field, lording over people as editors on their pages who have had decades of experience. Look at the MD, PhDs, the academic medical doctors who have published in peer-reviewed journals, who have opened up whole new venues for understanding how we can keep people healthier and have them live longer. And someone who has no background whatsoever in medicine, none in science, never published a paper, wouldn't know how to read a scientific study, is now the final arbiter of that courageous person's entire history and background. And when they do something that is not correct, there is no possible way on earth to have that corrected. They freeze that person's negative bios, and that's supposedly objective. That's not objective. That's putting someone in a gulag and saying you have a life sentence. You have been judged and condemned not by a group of your peers. These people are no one's peers. This is a problem that runs rampant on the encyclopedia. Novella believes that skepticism is a discipline unto itself, and those who criticize alternative medicine based upon the standard skepticisms are experts, regardless of their professional credentials. So let's understand this. You have no background whatsoever in medicine, science, clinical practice, and yet you're now an expert on a Deepak Chopra who has helped save thousands of lives, informed and improved the awareness of health issues in millions of people, who's done clinical studies, published in peer-reviewed literature, traveled the world, is highly acclaimed by his peers, but a non-peer is now the expert. My God. Think of that. Therefore, he argues, Novella, that for attacking any of the complementary and alternative medical systems that skeptics define as pseudoscience, quote, physician skeptics are not needed and have nothing particular to add, end quote. In other words, as long as skeptics remain loyal to their ideological principles, the mob has authority to rule over the public discourse about complementary and alternative medicine. However, Novella and his fellow skeptics delude themselves with their faux expertise. As biophysicist and neuroscientist Vincent Billock at Ohio State University Center for Cognitive and Brain Sciences states, quote, things that do not fit into the existing paradigm are hard to think about. Yeah. And it is with certainty that skepticism's leading voices are simply unable, in our opinion, to wrap their minds around the biophysical and quantum properties that may account for the efficacy of many of the alternative and natural medical systems, such as acupuncture and homeopathy and energy medicine. It is simply outside of their paradigmatic reductionist way of thinking. Therefore, we might excuse them for their intellectual dwarfism for the simple reason that modern medicine has become increasingly nested in a complex structure of institutional and political and economic relationships, and efforts to arrive at any truth regarding alternative medical therapies are plagued by the power dynamics enforced by the dominant system, meaning the corporate-driven medical institutions where profit is paramount, patients are secondary. Consequently, complementary and alternative medicine disciplines often confront a malicious environment, largely framed by skepticism that is determined to silence any scientifically viable evidence that indicates alternative and natural medical treatments may be safer and more effective than conventional protocols. I would refer you to the work of five MD and PhDs called Death by Medicine. It took 5 years of detailed scholarship, thousands and thousands of hours of reviewing all of the Orthodox medical establishment's records using their own database, only their database, to determine that they had failed miserably. Not only had they failed miserably to help cure people or reverse their disease or to prevent it, they actually contributed to their death and disability. Even the American Medical Association acknowledged that, and it was the third leading cause of disease. But the American Medical Association, not known for his scholarship in this case, had left out infections that a person develops in a hospital and dies, infections that developed after an operation, and also bed sores, like ulcers, and that led to gangrene and amputation or sepsis and died. Add all that together, and it's the number one cause of death in America each year, exceeding heart disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes. And it's the cause of the most injuries of anything in America. Not a word of criticism. Now, we are extremely good at critical care, and I compliment critical care. And we are extremely bad at all chronic care. But they have conflated the issues. If you talk in a way that is critical of what a person's given for cancer, like chemotherapy, that is itself a cause of cancer, then they're assuming you're critical of everything in medicine. That's not true. There are drugs that heal. There are drugs that at least help a person heal and can save a life. Their medical procedures can save life. But at least parse this out. 80% of American medicine is a gross failure and should not be practiced and should have the protocols changed and the people not rewarded. But that's not the way it works. And we published that and we sent it to 7,000 scientific magazines with all of our footnotes using their studies and statistics. Not a single person had the courage to publish it. We then sent it to 5,000 health journals, magazines, and newspapers. Not a single person reported on it. It was as if anyone mentioned it, then it would leak out. In its over-the-top efforts to destroy complementary and alternative therapies, you might ask, what does skepticism have to offer the public as a viable medical course of treatment? Well, quite simply, it is only the same old business-as-usual medical system, the one I just mentioned, entrusted to us by the pharmaceutical and insurance industries. In a perfect skeptic world, everything skepticism haphazardly labels as pseudoscience or quackery, including chiropractic, naturopathy, acupuncture, traditional Chinese and Indian medical systems, homeopathy, mind, body, and energy medicines, etc., would be ruled illegal. In return, skeptics can only offer patients a medical system that is rapidly decaying. Skeptics are adamant that besides their own publications, only clinical research published in prestigious peer-reviewed journals should be awarded credibility. Good. So you only want to reward peer-reviewed journals. Okay. According to Richard Horton, the editor-in-chief of The Lancet, quote, much of scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue, end quote. And by the way, The Lancet would not allow someone to make that statement unless it had been verified independently as being true. Many notable physicians and professors of medicine have noted the dire state of clinical research appearing in professional journals, including former chief editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Marcia Angell, now a Harvard Medical School professor. And Angell's estimation, quote, It is simply not possible to believe much of the clinical evidence that is published, end quote. She also worries about the enormous financial interest and influence drug companies have with medical school facilities. The integrity of medicine is being completely lost, and skeptics' failure and refusal to put more attention towards this trend that is really harming the lives of countless people in order to continue with its witch hunts against natural health displays in an arrogance that shows deep disregard towards public health, in our opinion. More disturbing, a University of Manchester meta-analysis of studies involving over 337,000 patients published in this current issue, this July issue of 2019 of the British Medical Journal, determined that, quote, 1 in 20 patients are exposed to preventable harm in medical care, end quote. What does that mean? Given the overprescription rates in the United States, the overmedication of everyone that they can in the United States, the pathologizing of normal conditions as diseases in the United States, it is not inconceivable that Americans are subject to much higher risks at the hands of conventional medicine. As Yale Medical School professor who represents his profession's train wreck of preventable injury and death, it is unconscionable, in our opinion, that Novella would apologetically exclaim that, quote, as a skeptical neurologist, I am not going to spend my time delving into and engaging in debate over the possible mechanisms of Parkinson's disease. There are scientists who are doing that, but I will engage with those claiming that near-death experiences are evidence of an afterlife because most scientists don't bother, end quote. With 4.25 billion, no, million, excuse me, people claiming near-death experiences are evidence of an afterlife. What we have is we have, excuse me, that was incorrect. It should be 4.25 billion retail prescriptions estimated to be filled in the United States a year. Think of that. We have 230 million more or less people in the United States and we're filling 4.2 billion prescriptions, each carrying safety warnings, many being severe. Skeptical obsessions with sick people being prayed over or visiting a homeopath is unscrupulous, and in the case of skeptic physicians, perhaps barbarous? Wow. Novella opines that, quote, billions, end quote, of dollars are being wasted by the government to fund research on complementary and alternative medical practices. Quote, my primary issue is alternative medicine, the abject infiltration of fraud and pseudoscience into the institutions of healthcare. This results in the wasting of billions of dollars diverting research funds and causes direct harm to the health of individuals. Prove it. Where's your evidence? Prove it. Besides his exaggeration, Novella's claims are laughable after review the facts. During the past 20 years, the National Institutes of Health National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health has spent less than $2.5 billion in 20 years. For example, this year it's the most they've ever spent, $146 million on grants to study complementary and alternative medical research, and almost all the grants are very small. This includes funding for many different kinds of therapies, from nutritional supplements and dietary therapies and acupuncture and botanical medicine to mind-body relaxation techniques. And we present a graph in the article showing you this. Therefore, for any single complementary and alternative therapy, the total amount is tiny. Quite frankly, this is a pittance of expenditures compared to the $39 billion of taxpayer dollars handed out annually for conventional medical research to about 300,000 researchers over 2,500 medical institutions. For this year alone, the National Institute of Health will spend $2.3 billion to study cardiovascular disease, $7.4 billion for cancer, and none for the third cause, which is medical error, not a penny. $500 million will be spent on research related to depression. And how successful has this investment been? Tens of millions have been spent alone to chase genes that are believed to be associated with depression. This has been a total waste now that the most comprehensive study of its kind to review so-called depression genes has recently concluded that the, quote, the hypothesis about depression candidate genes were incorrect, and that the large number of associated reported in the depression candidate gene literature are likely to be false positives, end quote. The National Institutes of Health PubMed database lists 4,000 studies for the presumed SLC6A4 depression gene, which has now been determined to be bogus. Professor Brian Martin at the University of Wollongong in Australia is widely acknowledged as the world's leading authority about the sociology of dissent and suppression in the modern sciences. By concerted character assassination, efforts to enforce censorship, blacklisting, creating obstacles for funding, and disseminating outright lies and misinformation, followers of oppressive thought, whether they be skeptics or Wahhabi radicals, demand consensus opinion. Those who oppose the consensus are regarded as foolish and therefore should be targeted for contempt. As the Saudi regime fears the shifting of the pendulum away from its medieval interpretation of Islam, so too skeptics blatantly make efforts to suppress that which competes with their deeply held scientific belief and ambitions. It is shared psychology to kill the messenger. Fortunately, this is not the Soviet Union, where the crime of being a renegade scientist peeking outside the accepted institutionalized science meant forced labor or death. Skeptics' intolerance of new ideas that challenge their limited view of reality in order to sustain scientific consensus, wrote Cornell Thomas Gold in his important 1989 essay, The New Ideas of Science, is representative of a, quote, a herd mentality, end quote. New ideas, such as science-based medicine or the atheistic science, according to Gold's premise, are, quote, not always right just because they are new, end quote. Nor are old ideas, such as acupuncture and the theory of subtle energy, or the ancient Ayurvedic medicine, quote, always wrong because they're old. If we are driving in the wrong direction, Gold continues, in the direction where no new ideas can be accepted, then even if scientific work goes on, the progress will be stilted, and that will end it. Skepticism's animosity to the new ideas being brought forth, by visionaries such as Rupert Sheldrake and Luc Montagnier and Deepak Chopra and many others, is not unlike the conventional musicians of the time calling Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, quote, an orgy of vulgar noises, end quote. Modern skepticism is a continuation of earlier scientism, a kind of quasi-religion of secular thought founded upon early naturalists. Naturalists declared that the only thing that exists is the natural world, and everything else is unfounded and therefore illusionary, to be shunned. It follows the old tired adage that I will only believe in what I can see, smell, taste, touch, and hear. In short, scientism, in Swedish philosopher Stenmark's words, is based upon the principle, quote, there is nothing outside the domain of science, nor is there any area of human life to which science cannot successfully be applied, end quote. So scientism purports to be rational, yet simultaneously is incapable of ascertaining other forms of non-scientific truth, such as subjective experience, consciousness, ethics, morals, metaphysical and aesthetic truths. Although the scientific method is incapable of ascertaining or disproving other truths, nevertheless, they too follow reason and logic, often every bit as rigorous as skepticism, reductionist determinism. Consequently, skepticism fundamentally breaches the fundamental norms of scientific dialogue and practice by resorting to a systematic strategy of suppression. This includes erroneously discrediting or silencing scientific claims and even scientists who propose theories or advocate for non-conventional medical intervention that challenge the dominant medical establishment. Yet this inherent system is a symptom in skeptical elitism that has been with our civilization for centuries. We might consider examples such as Louis Pasteur's germ theory first being denounced as ridiculous fiction, then John Baird, the inventor of the television, being labeled as a swindler by the British Royal Society. But they weren't. Or Lord Kevlin, perhaps Europe's most infamous elite scientist in the latter part of the 19th century, describing Wilhelm Röntgen's discovery of X-ray as, quote, an elaborate hoax. When the German meteorologist Alfred Wegener proposed his theory that all of the world's continents were once a single landmass, he was thoroughly ostracized by the scientific community and died an outcast. Today, the continental drift theory is recognized worldwide as a geological fact. When E.L. de Mol invented the tank, the British Admiralty called it idiotic and useless. Nobody has asked for them and nobody wants them, end quote. One of the more humorous examples is Warner Brothers Studios founder H.M. Warner declaring, quote, who the hell wants to hear actors talk? In 1927. And of course, Darwin's theory of evolution, one of the gospel texts of modern skepticism, was first regarded as utter nonsense by the scientific community of its time. There are numerous additional examples. Today, the heretics of skeptics criticize people who they consider quacks, including Luc Montagnier, the French Nobel laureate in medicine, for having discovered the HIV virus. Now Montagnier's attention is turned towards research, quote, the DNA transportation, which shares very close properties with that form of homeopathy efficacy. If the conclusions in his paper, quote, electromagnetic signals are produced by aqueous nanostructures derived from bacterial DNA sequences, end quote, receives widespread acceptance. Andy Coughlin, writing for the New Scientist, stated, quote, it would be, quote, the most significant experiment performed in the past 90 years, demanding reevaluation of the whole conceptual framework of modern chemistry. And his thought-provoking essay, quote, brilliant scientists are open-minded about paranormal stuff, so what? Scientific America writer John Horgan, which reviews many of the most important scientists in the modern era who entertain possibilities outside the scientific status quo of their times. But today, many of them, including William James, Carl Jung, and physicist Max Planck, and Wolfgang Pauli, and Edwin Schrodinger, and David Bohm, and Brian Josephson, all who believed in the possibility of paranormal phenomena and experience, are designated as loony by skeptics for holding such views. Our current 21st century skeptics are simply a continuation of the same elitist insolence that has been a formidable deterrent to scientific progress since the days when the medieval church persecuted science altogether. Not dissimilar to the Mudawahi, the Saudi religious police who compel obedience to the strict Wahhabi interpretation of Islam, skeptics, in our opinion, serve the scientific elite in strengthening their control over the dominant scientific paradigm, whether or not they realize it formally. During a debate with physicist and Buddhist scholar Dr. Alan Wallace, astrophysicist and skeptic Sean Carroll restated the hubris frequently entertained by a scientific elite, that is, science now knows everything about the universe that it needs to know. Really? During a TED talk shortly following 9/11, Dawkins took a cue right out of what could have been an Al-Qaeda manual and made his plea for, quote, militant atheism, although Dawkins was specifically calling for an unapologetic and disrespectful rationalist crusade against religion, his fundamental premise has been embraced throughout the skeptic movement in its efforts to silence, ridicule, demonize all who advocate alternative medicine and question conventional pharmaceutical drugs, vaccination, and industrial and genetically modified foods, pesticides, the junk food industry, etc. Medical treatments that fall outside the dominant elite's paradigm are categorically ruled as hoaxes and frauds. We have more to share, but we're out of time. I've only gone through half of our article. As I said at the beginning, it's a long article. But it's worth you taking your time to go to prn.fm and read it. And by doing so, share it with people. And why? Because skeptics at Wikipedia, being very biased, have taken upon themselves to determine that you should not have the right to know of the experiences of hundreds of millions of patients, of hundreds of thousands of clinicians, of natural alternative approaches to your disease. And we believe that in any society, you should have a right of freedom of choice. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.